The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine dated May 17th, 2013. And as usual, we will begin with the main story section of the Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled, Israel Raises the Stakes in Syria. The Obama administration faced growing pressure to intervene in Syria this past week after Israel launched two devastating air assaults on military facilities near Damascus, heightening fears that the Syrian civil war could soon escalate into a wider regional conflict. Israel refused to comment on the strikes, but U.S. officials said the attacks were aimed at caches of advanced Iranian-built missiles bound for the Lebanese Shiite militant group Hezbollah, a longtime foe of Israel. Several thousand Hezbollah fighters are thought to be fighting alongside Syrian government troops against the largely Sunni Muslim opposition. President Bashar al-Assad said the airstrikes proved that Israel was masterminding the rebellion against his government and threatening retaliation. For the first time, President Obama said the U.S. had a moral obligation to end the slaughter and ensure a stable Syria. But he said his bottom line was the best interest of America's security, and that he wouldn't order a military intervention based on unproven allegations that Assad's regime had used deadly sarin gas against rebel soldiers. Last year, Obama warned that Syria would cross a red line if it used chemical weapons and trigger a U.S. response. But senior administration officials this past week told the New York Times that Obama had ad-libbed the red line phrase and that it had left him in a box since he remains reluctant to commit any military forces to the conflict. A UN official said this week that evidence suggests that rebel groups, not the Syrian government, use the sarin. The White House, however, said it was likely that pro-Assad forces used the nerve agent. Now here's what the editorials had to say. Welcome to the non-interventionist Middle East, said the Wall Street Journal. When Syria's uprising began 2 years ago, the Obama administration warned that U.S. intervention could result in the rise of jihadists, the use of chemical weapons, and perhaps even a wider regional war. So the U.S. stayed out, and those bad results have happened in triplicate. To minimize the damage, Obama has to fully commit to ousting Assad, arm pro-Western rebels, and enforce a no-fly zone across Syria. The U.S. still has no vital security interest at stake, said Newsday, and this week's Israeli attack doesn't change that calculus. Israel was directly threatened by the long-range missiles it destroyed, but now that they've been eliminated, it wants no part of supporting Syria's rebels. The rebels' rank include radical Islamists and members of al-Qaeda, so sending arms there would be reckless. Now here's what the columnist said. The Obama administration has a bad case of Iraq syndrome, said Bill Keller in the New York Times. Haunted by that endless, disastrous conflict, the president is afraid to get the U.S. bogged down in a new Middle East quagmire. But Syria is not Iraq. This time we have a genuine imperiled national interest. If Syria collapses, it might trigger a regional Sunni-Shiite war that would spread to Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon. The use of sarin gas should also spur Obama into action, said Emmanuel Ottolenghi in CommentaryMagazine.com. If the rebels have gotten their hands on Assad's chemical weapons stockpile, it will only be a matter of time before Islamic terrorists use these WMDs somewhere else in the world. flying missions over Syria, either to enforce a no-fly zone or attack military targets, would be a high-risk operation, said David Wood in HuffingtonPost.com. First, the U.S. would have to eliminate Syria's extensive and sophisticated Russian-built air defenses. Many missile sites are hidden in densely populated urban areas, so U.S. bombing raids would likely kill large numbers of civilians. And what if the Syrians succeed in shooting down one of our jets? Should we send in ground troops to rescue the pilot? But the biggest argument against intervention is that no one can envision a good outcome, said Baxter Filkins in The New Yorker. Assad's fall will inevitably result in a power struggle between rebel groups, as well as a wave of genocidal ethnic cleansing against Assad's Alawite minority and Christians. And since the overwhelming majority of the rebels are fighting for an Islamic Republic, supplying them with military hardware could put American weapons in the hands of Al-Qaeda. As cruel as it sounds, the cost of trying to stop the carnage in Syria may simply be too high. The next article from the Week magazine here is entitled A GOP Immigration Backlash. Conservative Republicans pushed back forcefully this past week against an immigration reform bill championed by their colleague Senator Marco Rubio, attaching more than 300 amendments to the legislation and citing a Heritage Foundation claim that legalizing immigrants would cost taxpayers $6.3 trillion. The Senate Judiciary Committee has begun considering the amendments, which include requiring immigrants to provide DNA samples before being legalized, reducing the number of people who would be eligible for citizenship, and granting Congress more authority over security along the Mexico border. The debate over the 844-page bill is expected to last weeks. Here comes another blatant attempt to twist the immigration debate, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Conservatives are outrageously claiming that newly legalized immigrants would cost trillions of dollars more in services and benefits than they would pay in taxes. But the Heritage Foundation paper they cite, chock full of assumptions that most economists dispute, willfully disregards the indisputable economic benefits brought by new American workers. Just look at the history. Waves of previous Irish, Italian, and Jewish immigrants were greeted with similar prophecies of doom, yet still the United States thrived. The numbers might not be perfect, said David Frum in the DailyBeast.com. But it's true that immigration has costs, and those costs will be very, very large. Most of these legalized immigrants are low-productivity workers who won't generate enough growth to fund the services they and their descendants will use. Whether the shortfall is $4 trillion or $8 trillion, somehow it will have to be covered. And it's likely to disproportionately affect the poor, who will lose jobs to these competitors while wealthier Americans benefit from a flood of cheap labor. Conservatives would do well to remember that immigrants isn't a purely a fiscal question. Immigration is not purely a fiscal question, said Data Milbank in the Washington Post. If the Republican Party doesn't find a way to deal with the 11 million illegal immigrants in this country, Latino voters will assure political oblivion for the GOP. Rubio recognized this when he made himself the poster boy for this legislation. Let's hope for his party's sake that he's not left standing alone. The next item from the main story section is entitled New Testimony on Benghazi. The Obama administration botched its immediate response to last September's deadly attacks on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, then misled the public about them, according to State Department officials testifying this week before a House committee. Gregory Hicks, the Libyan embassy's deputy chief of mission, said he tried to get military assistance to Benghazi as the attacks were underway, but that troops in Tripoli were ordered not to fly there. The attacks left four Americans dead, including Ambassador Chris Stevens. Hicks said he briefed then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton during the search for Stevens and that he had told Washington earlier that evening that the consulate had been attacked by terrorists, not by angry protesters, as U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice later claimed on five Sunday morning talk shows. "I never reported a demonstration," he said. "I reported an attack." Mark Thompson, a coordinator in the State Department's Counterterrorism Bureau, said he believed the White House willfully lied about the attacks. Now it is more obvious than ever that the White House was quickly informed about the deadly sustained attack in Benghazi, said Jed Babin in Spectator.org. Yet they did nothing, even though the military had a host of assets just hours away. Republicans now have a where's the beef question on Benghazi. Why didn't the Obama administration attempt to rescue Americans under fire? Actually, it did, said Dave Weigel in Slate.com. A CIA response team was on the scene before the attacks were over. This is a disagreement about tactics, not a cover-up. This hearing wasn't really about Benghazi, said Howard Finneman in HuffingtonPost.com. Its sole purpose was to embarrass the president and tarnish Clinton's lofty image as the early 2016 frontrunner. These officials do seem credible, said Alex Seitz-Wald in Salon.com. But Republicans are discrediting themselves by pushing bogus storylines on Benghazi and trying to turn it into a second Watergate. The GOP has cried wolf on Benghazi so often that whatever minor scandal they do eventually dig up, mainstream America is unlikely to care. Now we'll turn to the controversy of the week, Obama's second term. Has he lost his juice? The president is fading, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. 100 days into his second term, President Obama is already acting like a lame duck and seems at the mercy of events. He couldn't get a Democratic-controlled Senate to pass a gun control bill supported by 90% of the public. His sequester strategy backfired. He's letting congressional Republicans take control of immigration reform, and he's floundering on Syria. When asked in a press conference last week if he had run out of juice, Obama glibly replied that rumors of my demise may be a little exaggerated, before once again blaming Republicans in Congress for refusing to work with him. Washington is undoubtedly dysfunctional, said Ron Fournier in NationalJournal.com, but the president is letting the Republican opposition grind him down into self-pitying passivity. Great presidents rise above circumstance. Obama seems to have lost the will to even try. The malaise gripping Washington can't be blamed on a lack of presidential juice, said Bob Shrum in the DailyBeast.com. It's the direct result of the Republican Party's nihilistic determination to block Obama at every turn. Republican Senator Pat Toomey admitted as much last week, saying the bill he co-sponsored requiring background checks for gun sales failed mainly because Republicans didn't want to be seen helping the president do something he wanted to get done. Liberals want to know why Obama can't work his will like Lyndon Johnson, but LBJ had two-thirds Democratic majorities in both houses and liberal Republicans as well. Obama has a Senate paralyzed by filibusters and a House controlled by Tea Party wingnuts. Believing that the president can fix this dysfunction with some magical feat of leadership is naive, said Ezra Klein in the Washington Post. Our system was designed to limit presidential power and to require extraordinary levels of consensus to operate smoothly. With the two parties more polarized than at any time in recent history, presidents are going to continue to fail because they can't possibly succeed. Still, Obama can't afford to sound like a defeatist, said E.J. Dionne Jr., also in the Post. He is spending too much time moaning about GOP intransigence and trying to woo Republicans with concessions like proposed cuts in Social Security benefits. No wonder that even his supporters are growing impatient. The GOP wants only to steadily weaken him, so Obama should stop bargaining, play hardball, and focus on rallying people behind such second-term agenda items as raising the minimum wage, providing universal pre-K, and rebuilding roads. Sorry, but in today's polarized climate, muscular public leadership actually is counterproductive, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. The harder Obama fights for legislation, the less likely it is to pass. That's why he's distanced himself from the immigration bill, for example. Leading from behind may have become a pejorative, but it is also a necessary form of presidential leadership. As a brilliant political tactician, Obama knows he's neither a dictator nor a decider, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. Instead, he's a catalyst for change. Look at how he waited for the right moment to publicly support gay marriage, adding critical momentum to that movement. Obama also succeeded in winding down two foreign wars and in expanding access to health care. The U.S. economy is slowly, slowly returning to health. Want more of that? Then demand that Congress do something other than obstruct. We're a republic, not a benevolent dictatorship. Now, from the column of the week, or the main news of the week here, we will turn to the popular column, A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for Judge Judy after the TV judge received a higher trust level in a poll of 1,000 Americans than any other jurist, including the 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a good week for hiring James Bond after England's Norland College, which has trained professional nannies for the rich and famous since 1892, announced it is now teaching its students martial arts and getaway driving so they can fight or escape kidnappers. And it was a good week for taking music lessons after French researchers found that 31% of women would give their telephone number to a man carrying a guitar, double the number who would hand their number to the same man when he was empty-handed. It was a bad week for sleeping soundly after the Air Force stripped 17 officers of authority at an intercontinental nuclear missile base in North Dakota. The launch crews got a D in an inspection and were deemed insubordinate and indifferent, with rot in the ranks. It was a bad week for runny noses after an Arizona man who suffered a constant drip for 18 months found out he was leaking brain fluid and needed surgery. You don't really think about it, but our brains are really just above our noses all of the time, said a neurosurgeon. And it was a bad week for consistency, too, after a Miami police officer who has been fired 8 times by 3 different police departments was sacked once again, this time for allegedly leaving his assault weapon with his girlfriend's father. Sergeant German Bosk said he would fight his dismissal, explaining, "I love serving the community." Now we'll turn to the briefing section of the Week magazine for this week, May 17th, 2013. The briefing article is entitled, "The Ecosystem Inside You." Your body harbors trillions of bacteria that have profound effects on your health, your weight, and even your mood. Don't bacteria make people sick? Well, many of them do, and antibiotics that kill them have saved countless lives. But over the past decade, researchers have discovered that the human body hosts 100 trillion mostly benign bacteria, which help digest food, program the immune system, prevent infection, and even influence mood and behavior. The bacteria living on and in us make up our microbiome, an ecosystem that plays a role, scientists believe, in many conditions that genes and environmental factors alone cannot explain, including obesity, autism, depression, asthma, and even cancer. The discovery of the microbiome, said Michael Fishback, a bioengineer at the University of California in San Francisco, has been very much like finding an organ we didn't know we had. Where is the microbiome? Bacteria thrive throughout our bodies, in our mouths and lungs, on our skin and teeth, and especially in our guts. The Human Microbiome Project, a government-supported effort to map our bacterial ecosystems, has discovered that people harbor 10 bacteria cells for every human cell. Every body hosts at least 10,000 different species of bacteria, contributing up to 5 pounds to body weight. Half of your stool is not leftover food. It is microbial biomass, said Project Director Lita Proctor. Last year, scientists presented evidence that everyone has one of three gut bacterial profiles, or enterotypes, characterized by high levels of specific bacterial species. Some argue that enterotypes are as distinct as blood types, and that learning more about them will help us design better drugs and target them more effectively. How do bacteria influence health? Microbiome research is in its infancy, but there is already evidence that an imbalance of gut flora may cause gastrointestinal problems such as irritable bowel syndrome and Crohn's disease. Bacteria may also help calibrate our basal metabolism. When obese people undergo gastric bypass surgery to lose weight, scientists have observed their gut bacteria become more like those harbored by thin people, contributing to weight loss. Microbes can even influence mental states by encouraging neurons in the intestines to signal the brain to alter hormone levels. Studies in mice have shown that changes in gut bacteria can relieve or cause depression and anxiety. It has also been shown that autistic children who frequently suffer from gastrointestinal problems often carry a type of gut bacteria that non-autistic children don't. Why the difference in bacteria? Some 80% of an individual's gut flora comes from his or her mother. A newborn exits the womb microbe-free, but is colonized by the mother's vaginal bacteria as it passes through the birth canal. Babies born via cesarean section, it turns out, enter life with an entirely different and less diverse collection of bacteria, which may help explain why they're at increased risk of asthma, obesity, and type 1 diabetes. Breast milk, unlike formula, also delivers maternal bacteria that help the immune system develop. Can the microbiome change? Yes, for good and for ill. Diet plays a major role in determining what bacteria people host. A recent study found that when certain gut bacteria feed on compounds in red meat or egg yolk, they produce an artery-hardening compound called TMAO. People who rarely eat red meat or egg yolks don't carry the same TMAO-producing bacteria, and so can eat those foods occasionally without increasing their heart disease risk. Older people who live independently tend to have more diverse microbiomes than their frailer peers who live in nursing homes, maybe because of their different diets. But it's unclear whether a narrower microbiome causes declining health or is a consequence of it. Antibiotic use can also reduce gut flora. Researchers are still trying to determine what factors could set the microbiotic in a good direction versus a bad direction, said University of Colorado biochemist Rob Knight. There are very few cases where cause and effect are known. Can bacteria be used to treat illness? In at least one case, they already are. C. difficile infections caused by a bacterium that can take over the gut cause severe diarrhea and kill 14,000 Americans per year. C. difficile is notoriously difficult to eradicate with antibiotics. But researchers have discovered that transplanting a healthy person's stool via a tube inserted into the patient's stomach cures the infection almost instantly by repopulating the patient's microbiome with healthy bacteria. Telling C. difficile infections often begin after a person takes antibiotics to treat an unrelated condition. Some experts suggest that the widespread use of antibiotics, which kill good bacteria along with the harmful bacteria they target, could help explain the skyrocketing rates of asthma, obesity, and autism. Whenever they are used, there is collateral damage, said New York University microbiologist Martin J. Blaser, and we are only now fully learning how severe that damage has been. Scientists are now trying to figure out what constitutes a healthy microbiome in hopes that they can treat health problems by tweaking the mix of a person's bacterial species. The prospects here are endless, Blaser said. This is the most exciting and important work of my lifetime. And the footnote to this briefing article is entitled "The Probiotics Boom." Pills, drinks, and yogurts containing probiotics, live beneficial bacteria, have become a big business. In 2011, global sales of probiotics reached $28 billion and are expected to reach $42 billion in 2016. But experts remain skeptical of commercial claims, often unverified by clinical trial, that they bolster the immune system, improve digestion, and generally optimize our health. A review of probiotic research by scientists at Yale found that certain strains did appear to reduce diarrhea and alleviate irritable bowel syndrome, and other studies show that they could shorten colds. But researchers still aren't sure which bacterial strains are helpful for which conditions and how they interact with a given person's existing microbiome. The science has been shoddy and flimsy, said bioengineer Michael Fishback. Probiotics may well be the future of medicine, but they should be more complicated and also more rigorously tested than today's probiotics, he says. They'll be something that your doctor prescribes. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service for this week, May 17th, 2013. Thanks so much for joining me today. And now we will take a look at the best columns in the U.S. according to the week. The first one is entitled, "How to Stop the Abuse of Foreign Labor" by T.A. Frank in The New Republic. American consumers can't stop big retailers from sending their manufacturing work abroad, said T.A. Frank. But surely we can demand that foreign workers making our clothes, electronics, furniture, and toys aren't poisoned, enslaved, or killed. The recent garment factory collapse in Bangladesh, which killed at least 650 workers, was a horrific reminder of how third world factories treat their workers. Big U.S. retailers routinely give their manufacturing business to the lowest bidders, which are usually foreign factories that save money by skimping on basic safety, such as proper ventilation for workers using poisonous glues or paints, or basic fire prevention and building maintenance. Here's a simple way to address the gross mistreatment of workers. Insist on disclosure. Congress should require companies that order more than $100,000 worth of goods from abroad to inspect those factories and publish their findings online. Serial offenders like Walmart will howl in chagrin because the truth about how our products are made is deeply shameful. But making the truth available could greatly reduce poisoning, enslaving, and killing. The next column is entitled, "From the Chum Gang to Enforcer," by Nick Gillespie at thedailybeast.com. How times change, said Nick Gillespie. While in high school, Barack Obama was a proud member of a pot-smoking, party-hardy crew that called itself the Chum Gang. He was famed for his interceptions, snatching a joint that was making the rounds, shouting intercepted, and taking a big toke. As President Obama has continued this habit of bogarting other people's joints, turning himself into a hardcore drug warrior, he's directed the federal government to crack down on medical marijuana dispensaries, even though they're legal in 18 states, and continued the futile practice of sending billions of dollars to wage war on drug producers in Mexico, Latin America, and Asia. This war has been a disaster, failing to stop the flow of drugs while filling our prisons with young, nonviolent offenders. As a younger politician, Obama recognized the futility of prohibition, saying as a Senate candidate in 2004 that the U.S. should rethink the drug war. But on his way up the ladder, Obama turned his back on civil liberties and adopted a drug policy that's indistinguishable or worse than George W. Bush's. Mr. Choom Gang has become Mr. Hypocrite. And the next column is entitled A House That Stuck in the 1950s by Timothy Egan in NYTimes.com. The House of Representatives doesn't represent America as it really is today, said Timothy Egan. The Republican-controlled House governs a fantasy nation created in talk radio land, where black and gay people don't exist, women remain subservient, and all gun safety legislation is a step toward tyranny. Thanks to a strategic redrawing of districts, Republicans managed to maintain a 33-seat advantage in the House in the 2012 elections, despite collectively getting 1.4 million fewer votes than Democrats. As America becomes more diverse, House Republicans barricade themselves in homogeneous red state districts where extremism is no vice. Of 41 blacks in the House, zero are Republicans. Of 34 Latinos, just seven are Republicans. Of seven openly gay and bisexual members, none are from the GOP. Just 8% of Republican members are women. The retrograde GOP Boys Club is comically out of step, emphatically opposing common-sense legislation supported by a large majority of Americans, from universal background checks for gun sales to immigration reform. In their parallel universe, democracy is dangerous and obstruction is the only goal. Now we'll flip to the back of the week magazine for the last word. This week, the last word article is entitled, Taking Out the Trash. Garbage men are largely invisible, said Robin Nagel, but they make modern cities possible. It was a radiant autumn morning. Tree leaves and car windows sparkled. The garbage bags that filled the back of our collection truck shimmered as Ray Kurtz pulled the handles that activated the bawling hydraulics of the hopper blade. Eager to be useful, I leaned against the load so no errant pieces would fall out, then stepped aside while the blade moved down and pushed the pile into the truck's body. Kurtz, who was 48 years old, had about 18 years as a New York City sanitation worker, or garbage man in common parlance. His partner, who threw bags toward us, was Sal Federici, 50-ish, with more than 20 years on the job. Both names are pseudonyms for people who wish to remain anonymous. All of us create trash in great quantities, but it's a troubling category of stuff that we mostly ignore. We particularly ignore how much care and attention it requires from a large, well-organized workforce. What would life be like if the people responsible for managing the waste of contemporary society were not on the streets every day? What do their jobs entail? Why don't they get the kudos they deserve? I decided to look for answers among the men and women of my city's Department of Sanitation. The best way to learn about their work was to do it with them, which is how I found myself behind the truck on that beautiful morning, marveling at the light and trying not to get in Kurtz's way. Both Kurtz and Federici had spent their careers in a sanitation district called Manhattan 7, and both had enough seniority to be regulars in Section 1, the district's plum assignment. The one has a reputation for clean garbage. The bags don't often break, and maggots are less common, even in summer's heat. Kurtz was the driver and Federici the loader, but both men tossed bags. That particular day, on a block of fastidiously restored brownstones near Central Park West, we were doing house to house. We picked up the garbage left in front of one small building, a townhouse or a modest apartment complex or a church, for example, and then moved the truck forward a stoop or two to get the pile that waited in front of the next small building, and the next, and the next. The workforce of sanitation is surprisingly small. New York's 8.2 million residents are served by fewer than 10,000 sanitation employees, all of whom make it possible for the DSNY to carry out its three-part mandate. The first two parts involve picking up the garbage and figuring out where to put it. Sanitation makes sure that more than 6,000 miles of streets are swept several times a week and that the city's 11,000 tons of household trash and 2,000 tons of household recycling are collected every day. Snow removal, the department's third duty, is a large task that occupies more than just the winter months. The Manhattan 7 garage serves the Upper West Side neighborhood, which is where I was working with Kurtz and Federici. It's one of the 59 districts into which the department divides itself across the city. Districts or garages are managed through seven borough-based commands. There are five boroughs in New York, but sanitation splits Queens into West and East, Brooklyn into North and South. Manhattan has 12 districts, as does the Bronx. Brooklyn North and Brooklyn South have 9 districts each. Queens East and Queens West have 7 each, and Staten Island has 3. Geography, staffing needs, and equipment allocations vary from one garage to the next. Manhattan 1, for example, is a small district of just 3 sections. M1 covers the Wall Street area, runs about 20 collection trucks and 15 recycling trucks a week, and hosts 55 workers, officers, and support staff across all shifts. Queens East 13, so big that it's called the Ponderosa, covers 8 sections out of 2 garage facilities. Each week, about 185 collection trucks, 72 recycling trucks, and 200 workers serve the neighborhoods of Laurelton, Rosedale, Bella Rose, and Queens Village. If truck allocations are the measure, Manhattan 7, which has 5 sections and runs about 100 collection and 50 recycling trucks a week, is the borough's second busiest. 4 of M7's 5 sections boast trendy shops, lace curtain restaurants, and a surfeit of luxury residential real estate, which varies from well-kept single-family homes and block-square pre-war palaces to big-box newcomers like Donald Trump's mammoth structures on a former rail yard overlooking the Hudson River. In the 5 section, the district's northernmost, Spanish is heard as often as English, and corner bodegas are more common than high-end retailers. Kurtz, Federici, and I were making our way down a street lined with tall sycamore trees and elegant townhomes when all at once, as if she had materialized out of the remarkable morning light, a muse appeared. She was tall, slender, in her mid-20s, with flawless olive skin, large eyes, full lips. Her hair, neat behind her shoulders, bounced lightly in sync with her brisk footsteps. Kurtz was staggered. He leaned against the truck, folded his arms, and gazed at her. When a trace of her perfume reached us, he closed his eyes and inhaled deeply. He smiled hugely, his eyes still closed, and I smiled as well to see a man so frankly enjoy the sight and scent of a woman. I didn't know it yet, but that morning on the street, I was also observing a man who could stare so blatantly because any potentially disapproving members of the public wouldn't notice him doing it. In fact, as Kurtz knew well, passerbys didn't even see him. Years on the job had taught him that when he put on his uniform every morning, like Federici and every other sanitation worker in the city, he became invisible. Uniforms in general change the way any worker is perceived. The man or woman wearing a uniform becomes the police officer, or the firefighter, the soldier, the doctor, or the chef. Individuality is subsumed by the role that the clothing implies. But the sanitation worker is more than just subsumed by a role. Because of the mundane, constant, and largely successful nature of his work, his uniform acts as a cloaking device. It erases him. Effective garbage collection and street cleaning are primary necessities if urban dwellers are to be safe from the pernicious effects of their open detritus. When garbage lingers too long on the streets, vermin thrive, disease spreads, and city life becomes dangerous in ways not common in the developed world for more than a century. It is thus an especially puzzling irony that the first line of defense in any city's ability to ensure basic health and well-being of its citizenry is so persistently unseen, but the problem is hardly unique to New York City. John Coleman, president of Haverford College in the early 1970s, spent part of a sabbatical working as a garbage man near Washington, D.C. His route took him to a Tony suburban neighborhood. "I thought this might mean more talk back and forth as I made the rounds today," he mused. "While I wouldn't have time to talk at length, there was time to exchange the greetings that go with civilized ways. This was where I got my shock. Both men and women gave me the silent or staring treatment. A woman in housecoat and curlers, putting her last tidbit of slops into the pail, was startled as I came around the corner of her house. At the sound of my greeting, she gathered her housecoat tightly about her and moved quickly indoors. I heard the lock click. Another woman had a strange large animal, more like a vicuna than anything else, in her yard. I asked her what kind of dog it was. She gaped at me. I thought she was hard of hearing and asked my question louder. There was a touch of a shudder before she turned coldly away. A man playing ball with his two sons looked over in response to my voice, stared without a change of face, and then calmly threw the next ball to one of the boys. And so it went in almost every yard. The sociologist Wayne Brekus might point to sanitation work as an example of an unmarked element of daily life. The world around us more completely comprehended if we look for phenomena that are usually unnoticed. Unextraordinary, he calls them, and therefore unanalyzed. They stand in contrast to things, relationships, identities, or behaviors that are marked claims, Brekus. These garner a lot of attention and are often used as examples that purport to illustrate larger realities, but recognizing only marked phenomena distorts our understanding of the world. Labors of waste certainly qualify as unmarked. But a sanitation worker is not physically invisible. Coleman wasn't wearing a magic cloaking device when he was collecting garbage, nor do New York sanitation crews become see-through when they're on the street. Rather, their consistent state of the not-there-ness is a status given to them by the larger culture. When going about their everyday chores, sanitation workers are willfully unseen by the public. A sanitation worker's career is focused on objects and debris that others have decided merit no further attention. His work is preventive, not reactive, and thus it becomes marked only when it's not done. A steady joke among san workers is that they get attention on only a few occasions. One of them is a missed pickup. Systematic garbage collection was instituted in New York less than 120 years ago, but since then the public has come to rely on the service as unexceptional. No matter the circumstances, a blizzard, a terrorist attack, a blackout, a hurricane, the garbage gets picked up. The sanitation worker is as unremarkable and as certain to arrive as the morning sun. Sanitation is the most important uniformed force on the street, No city can thrive without a workable solid waste management plan. Before problems of rubbish and street cleaning were solved, much of New York was infamously filthy. Thousands upon thousands of people who had no choice but to endure streets shin-deep in all manner of debris died in extravagant numbers of diseases that even back then were largely preventable. Responses to this constellation of horrors came from many quarters, but effective garbage collection was one of the bedrock foundations upon which reform was built. The claim extends beyond public health. Sand workers are key players in maintaining the most basic rhythms of capitalism. Material consumption always includes, though seldom acknowledges, the necessity of disposal. If consumed goods can't be discarded, the space they occupy remains full, and new goods can't become part of a household. Because sanitation workers take away household trash, the engines of our consumption-based economy don't sputter. Though this is a simplistic description of a dense and complex set of processes, the fundamental reality is straightforward. Used-up stuff must be thrown out for new stuff to have a place. New Yorkers know none of this. They put their garbage out at night, quip old-time sanitation personnel, and think the garbage fairies make it all go away. And that was from an article called Picking Up on the Streets and Behind the Trucks with the Sanitation Workers of New York City by Robin Nagel. Now, from the last word, we'll head to the health and science section of the Week magazine for this week. The first article is entitled Proof of Cannibalism at Jamestown. Starving settlers of Jamestown, the first English settlement in the New World, resorted to cannibalism to survive the harsh winter of 1609 and 10, new research has revealed. Anthropologists excavating a trash pile from the period have unearthed the skull and tibia of a 14-year-old girl cannibalized by desperate settlers, the Washington Post reports. After the girl died, someone made tentative chops to her forehead before an axe was used to open her skull. Small scraping knife marks were found on her jaw and cheekbones. The clear intent was to dismember the body, remove the brain and flesh from the face for consumption, says Douglas Owsley of the National Museum of Natural History. Settlers call that first winter at Jamestown the starving time, as disease whittled away their ranks, supply ships never arrived, and constant attacks by the Powhatan Indians prevented them from foraging and hunting. Written accounts indicate that the settlers ate their horses, dogs, cats, and leather boots, and that one man was executed for murdering and eating his wife. Until now, however, there was no forensic proof of cannibalism. Researchers believe the cannibalized girl arrived at Jamestown in the late summer of 1609, when the colony had 400 settlers. When supply ships finally arrived the following May, only 60 were still alive. The next article, an organ made from stem cells. A toddler born without a windpipe has been given one made in a laboratory, making her the youngest person ever to receive a bioengineered organ. No one with Hannah Warren's rare birth defect, tracheal agenesis, has lived past age 6, and the 2-year-old had spent every day of her life with a tube down her throat, unable to breathe, swallow, eat, or drink on her own. But in a groundbreaking procedure, surgeons created a trachea by bathing a plastic tube for a week in stem cells extracted from Hannah's bone marrow. When they implanted the new trachea, the cells are thought to have signaled other cells in her body to grow additional tissue, integrating it into her body. Hannah's success after the experimental operation performed in Peoria, Illinois, is really showing that the technique is workable, says Anthony Atala, director of Wake Forest University's Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Lead surgeon Paolo Macarina tells the Associated Press that Hannah will go from being a virtual prisoner in a hospital bed to running around and playing with her sister and enjoying a normal life. The next article, What Sleeping Babies Hear? The voices babies hear while they're asleep can permanently shape their developing brains. That's the conclusion of researchers at the University of Oregon who scanned the brains of sleeping 6 to 12-month-old babies while playing them nonsense sentences spoken in angry, happy, or neutral tones. They found that each of the tones activated different regions in the infant's brains, suggesting that they didn't need to be awake to take in oral information. Researchers also discovered that the brains of babies who came from high-conflict homes where their parents shouted at each other reacted especially strongly to the angry voice. That reactivity is in brain regions that we think are important later on in terms of your ability to regulate your emotions and function well. Study author Alice Graham tells NPR.org. It's unclear, though, what that extra sensitivity means for the baby's future. It could change the brain in ways that make them more prone to behavioral problems, but it could also help the brain develop resistance to the psychological damage often caused by exposure to parental conflict. And the next one is entitled A Cure for the Wandering Eye. Taking a common antibiotic can help men resist the allure of attractive women, Nature reports. Researchers recruited 100 men and gave half of them a course of minocycline, an antibiotic used to treat acne that also appears to improve decision-making. Then they asked them to play a game of trust in which the men had to decide how much money to give to women of varying attractiveness, knowing that some women could opt to keep it all while others would give back triple what they got. The men who weren't taking minocycline acted like typical men, giving more money to the women they considered highly attractive. The men on the antibiotic treated all of the women the same. That suggests minocycline may disrupt the tendency of men to lavish attention and gifts on pretty women in order to seduce them and increase the probability of producing attractive offspring, the study authors say. For unexplained reasons, minocycline seems to affect the brain, improving focus and mood. And the final article from the Health and Science section this week, Health Scare of the Week, Frosty Treatment for the Obese. Physicians aren't as kind to their obese patients as they are to their normal weight patients, and that could make a major difference to the health of overweight people. Johns Hopkins University researchers tape recorded the visits of more than 200 patients to one of 39 primary care doctors for help with high blood pressure. The transcript showed no overt discrimination, with doctors spending roughly the same amount of time with all of the patients. But doctors were far more likely to express warmth and to commiserate with normal weight patients, responding to their health complaints with comments like, "I'm glad you're feeling better," or "I agree with you." That gets extremely frustrating. There was less of that with overweight patients, from whom the doctors maintained an emotional distance. They were just not engaging patients in that rapport building, study author Kimberly Gudzoon tells the New York Times. That bias can have far-reaching consequences. Studies show patients are much more likely to follow medical advice, improve their health, and lose weight if they believe their doctors empathize with them. Now, as we reach the end of the program, we'll turn to the talking points section here for a few shorter items. The national suicide rate rose 31% from 1999 to 2010, driven by a spike in suicides among baby boomers in their 50s. Mental health experts pointed to hopelessness brought on by job loss, foreclosure, and the pressures of caring for aging parents and difficult teenagers. At $900,000 per inmate per year, Guantanamo Bay is now the world's most expensive prison. By comparison, super maximum security prisons in the U.S. spend about $60,000 to $70,000 to house their inmates, while the average annual cost across all federal prisons is about $30,000 per year. The final two pieces of a 408-foot spire have been placed on top of One World Trade Center. Now, once the building is complete, it will stand at a height of 1,776 feet. That's 1,776 feet, the tallest building in the Western Hemisphere. Shortly before the Boston Marathon bombing, Al-Qaeda in Yemen posted on the web the lone Mujahid pocketbook, a 64-page manual for Muslims who want to wage jihad against the kuffar, the unbelievers. Tips include how to build a pressure cooker bomb, which the manual says should be placed in crowded areas. Male veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have a 76% higher rate of death by car accident than non-veterans. Aggressive driving learned in war zones may be a factor, according to an article in the Washington Post. And now we'll take a look at the poll watch for this week from the Week magazine. 70% of Americans believe that accused Boston bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev should receive the death penalty if convicted. 72% of Americans aged 50 to 64 say they are worried about having enough money to retire. 63% are worried they won't be able to pay their medical costs if they get a serious illness, and that is according to a study by the Gallup organization. We have just about reached the end of our program for our reading this week. Be sure to join me again next time. I hope that you enjoyed our reading today. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.